Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN criticizes Britain's Rwanda migrant law as another boat tragedy shows the dangers of crossing.
By shifting the responsibility for refugees, reducing the UK court's ability to scrutinize removal decisions, this new legislation seriously hinders the rule of law in the UK, and it sets a perilous precedent globally.
Malawi takes steps to end poverty among women and girls. Ongoing rainfall leads to the closure of key roads in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The World Bank suspends tourism financing to Tanzania over alleged human rights violations. A new World Bank report says living conditions are worsening for half of the world's poorest countries.
These are the world's poorest countries, and the fact that their per capita incomes are projected over the next decade to not be rising rapidly enough to narrow this gap is a big concern.
And artificial intelligence surrounds U.S. political life during this election year. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. After years of political wrangling and court battles, British lawmakers passed legislation this week which the government hopes will allow it to deport asylum seekers arriving in small boats across the English Channel to Rwanda for processing. As Henry Richwell reports from London, the dangers of the migrant crossings were underlined just hours after the law was passed.
A grim reminder of the dangers of the migrant journeys across the English Channel. Five people died, including a young child, when an overloaded inflatable dinghy carrying migrants got into difficulties off the French coast Tuesday morning. French authorities say 112 people were on board.
Et malgré cette situation complexe et délicate, 57 personnes.
Jacques Billon, the prefect of the French Pas-de-Calais region, said that despite the complex and delicate situation, 57 people who were still on the inflatable boat remained on board. Not willing to be rescued, they managed to restart the engine and continue their sea route towards Britain, he added. Such is the determination of migrants to reach Britain. Over 6,300 people have made the journey in small boats so far this year. The tragedy came just hours after British lawmakers passed legislation aiming to send to Rwanda all asylum seekers arriving across the English Channel. Migrants would be processed in Rwanda and have no right to return to Britain, even those granted refugee status. The legislation effectively orders the courts to ignore existing British laws or international treaties that could block the deportations. It's not yet clear if further legal challenges could delay the flights. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the prospect of being sent thousands of kilometres away to Rwanda will deter migrants from making the journey to Britain.
The first flight will leave in 10 to 12 weeks. Now, of course, that is later than we wanted, but we have always been clear that processing will take time.
The government argues the policy is moral as it aims to end the dangerous journeys operated by people smugglers. But the United Nations called for Britain to rethink the legislation. Ravina Shamdasani, spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights.
By shifting the responsibility for refugees, reducing the UK court's ability to scrutinise removal decisions, restricting access to legal remedies in the UK, and limiting the scope of domestic and international human rights protections for a specific group of people, this new legislation seriously hinders the rule of law in the UK, and it sets a perilous precedent globally.
Under the deal, Britain is paying Rwanda at least $458 million over 5 years, with extra payments on top worth tens of thousands of dollars for each migrant sent to the country. The opposition has called it an expensive gimmick that won't work. The passing of the legislation after years of delay is a political victory for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Whether the policy deters migrants from making the deadly journeys across the English Channel remains to be seen. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
A new World Bank report says living conditions are worsening for half of the world's poorest countries, with poverty levels growing in what it calls a historical reversal of development. Danny Lipsiger is a professor of international business at George Washington University and a former vice president for poverty reduction and economic management at the World Bank. He tells viewers Chinedu Ofor that the prospects for growth in these countries are not positive.
The income gaps that were beginning to narrow a bit between rich and poor countries are now widening once again. And so if we take out China and other, you know, large countries that have had a lot of progress on poverty, we're basically talking about the poorest, what the World Bank would call the IDA countries, which is basically sub-Saharan Africa, a few countries in Central America or South Asia. These are the world's poorest countries, and the fact that their per capita incomes are projected over the next decade to not be rising rapidly enough to narrow this gap is a big concern.
What does this mean for the average citizen of these countries in terms of their lives and their hopes and their plans for a better tomorrow?
To the extent that developing countries have greater difficulty in exporting, don't generate sufficient revenue, and can't do the proper level of investment that's needed in infrastructure and health and education, etc., this affects people's lives. I think it's also fair to say that the external sector for many countries is important, but equally important are internal policies. And I think we have other World Bank reports and other international organizations like the IMF that have looked at what's happening inside poor countries. And unfortunately, a lot of domestic policies are also lagging in terms of their efficiency, their effectiveness, and their insulation from political influence and corruption.
Will this report be an incentive for anyone living in some of these countries to want to leave? There's a lot of movement from Africa, from Asia, to richer countries. And a lot of people are unfortunately dying trying to cross the Mediterranean.
Income earnings differentials between what a 20-year-old can earn in Mali and what they think they can earn in Europe is going to be, you know, 20 to 1 or 50 to 1. You're going to see migration. I don't think that's the issue. I think the reason why this report is important is it came out in the week of the what we call the spring meetings here in Washington, the IMF World Bank semi-annual meetings. And I think the World Bank was trying to make a case that more money needed to go into their International Development Association funding. These are the almost near grant transfers that accompany projects that the World Bank does in the poorest countries. So I think this was a call to arms to try to get donors to pony up more money, because the situation has gotten worse than it was a decade ago.
Danny Lipsiger is a professor of international business at George Washington University and former vice president for poverty reduction and economic management at the World Bank. He spoke with VOA's Chinedu Ofor from Washington, D.C. The government of Tanzania says it does not violate the rights of its citizens. This comes as the World Bank says it has suspended financing intended to develop tourism in the Ruaha National Park area due to allegations of killings, rape, and forced evictions of the local Maasai. The bank says the allegations, if true, breach its policies in the implementation of the project. Government spokesperson Mumbari Matani tells me that anyone relocated because of the project would be accorded all their rights.
Yes, we have seen the reports that the World Bank is suspending the remaining amount. We were supposed to get 150 in the whole project. We have already received $125 million so far. So we were almost there. The World Bank has suspended, meaning that they are going to, first of all, seek some clarification on the accusations that have been leveled against us. They are baseless accusations that we as the government, we are violating human rights, which is not the case. The project is still ongoing. It's not going to stop, even though the World Bank has suspended that amount. But we already have enough amount to continue with the project. There is no problem with anyone living around that area, Ruaha National Park. We are actually having a project that will expand the size of the national park. and whoever is supposed to be allocated to another place is going to have all the rights as a human being. We respect the human rights.
The World Bank is suspended the funding because of, it says, allegations of human rights violations. Who is violating the human rights?
The government cannot do that. We never do those kind of things. It may happen, maybe. Maybe one of the government employees may probably do something that's not actually ethical, but as a government would not condone anything of that nature. Therefore, we'll have to investigate. Is there anyone among our employees who has done something that is not rightful? But as a government, that's not our policy. And in case we find such a thing, then we'll have to take the appropriate measures.
When you mentioned the last time that you were involved in dispute resolution, who are you resolving this dispute with? Is it with the local people?
Actually, the possibility of a dispute is there. Because there are some of the local people, to be frank, sometimes they may encroach into an area which is designated as a national park or a game reserve. We do have those kind of instances. And like I said, we do have our laws that can address those kind of things.
You were planning of redrawing the boundaries. Are you going to reconsider that because of this decision by the World Bank?
We'll just go ahead. We are not going to halt any project because everything is very well planned.
Mobare Martine is the spokesperson for the Tanzanian government. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. The executive director of the Oakland Institute, a policy think tank based in California, is welcoming a World Bank decision to suspend funding for a tourism project in Tanzania following allegations of human rights violations. Executive Director Anuradha Mittal tells me that the suspension of funding should send a resounding message to the Tanzanian government that there are consequences for those who violate human rights to boost tourism.
At the Oakland Institute, we are pleased to see that the World Bank has finally taken action, even if very late, to suspend the financing of the redraw project, given the harms it has caused to the local communities that it was supposed to benefit. At the same time, we are very conscious of the fact that the project financing started in 2017. We pointed out the problems with the project, and that is a very mild word to use. We're talking about severe human rights abuses. We're talking about forced evictions. We're talking about a lot of violence, no grievance mechanism. We went to the World Bank over a year ago. So because of this delay, these harms have continued to the communities. So while we are pleased, we also hope that the bank will look at making sure that justice is ensured, that these communities are paid reparations for the harms they have experienced.
Can you describe the abuses you mentioned in your complaint?
Well, in last year in October, we released a report called Unaccountable and Complicit, and that report details extensively the abuses that the communities have faced at the hands of the Tanapa Rangers. To intimidate people, to force them to leave, people have disappeared. There have been killings. There have been sexual assaults and rapes. There have been violent beatings of the villagers. Additionally, what they also experience is a lot of those villagers are pastoralists. So thousands of cows have been seized by the Tanapa Rangers and then auctioned. Now, these kind of livelihood restrictions have made life impossible for the people who had been hoping for development.
So the Tanzanian government had told the World Bank that it was going to look into the complaints. Did it reach out to your organization?
Well, the Tanzanian government has not reached out to us, but the Tanzanian government is one that we are very aware of its deeds, not just in the southern district in Ruaha, but if you looked at the violent demarcations carried out in Loliondo, if you look at what it has done in the Gorongoro Conservation Area, this is a government which is trying to boost tourism, safari tourism, game parks, hunting, forgetting that it is the indigenous who have preserved the areas which are known to the world as the Serengeti. So the decision by the World Bank sends a very clear message to the Tanzanian government that it cannot continue as business as usual.
Anuradha Mittal is the executive director of the Oakland Institute, a policy think tank based in California. She was speaking with us from New Delhi, India. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 24th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Malawi and its development partners are trying something new to help the country's most vulnerable women and girls get out of extreme poverty. Besides enhancing their socioeconomic status, a new three-year program will strengthen their resilience to crises, shocks, and disasters. Lamek Mazina reports from Blantyre.
The UN Children Agency, UNICEF, and the Irish government say more than 20% of Malawi's 19.6 million people live in extreme poverty. They said Tuesday women had over 75% of all families living in poverty amid violence and harmful practices that undermine their participation in economic activities. The new Gender Empowerment and Resilience Program is expected to benefit more than 500,000 people in 9 districts, giving them access to social services and cash transfers. The districts are Nzimba, Ncheu, Balaka, Chikwawa, Mulanje, Mwanza, Neno, Msanje, and Zomba. Shadrack Omo is UNICEF representative in Malawi. He says experience has shown that parents and caregivers need to be supported with livelihoods and resources to support their children.
That's why this program, which is supported by the Malawi government, European Union, and UNICEF, is extremely important, because through this program, we'll be working with parents to support them to have the right livelihoods and incomes to support their children to grow to their full potential.
About $26 million is being spent to tackle challenges that would help give Malawi women access to economic opportunities and essential social services. Besides cash transfers, the program will help promote access to social behavior change, nutrition, early childhood development, sexual reproductive health, and prevention of gender-based violence. Minister of Gender, Community Development and Social Welfare, Jean Sendeza, says in a statement that Malawi has previously made progress in expanding social protections to reach more vulnerable people. However, she says significant gender gaps remain. NLS Pemba is the executive director for Chikundi Girls Project in southern Malawi. She welcomes the program, but says similar interventions haven't yielded results in the past because of a tendency of imposing solutions without even asking what people really want.
Because we feel like sometimes a girl child just wants money. But well, there are a lot of issues that are happening. For example, when you talk about mental health issues, a girl child, maybe the parent is sick, both of them, or they don't have food at home, like we are facing like hunger in Malawi now.
Pemba, whose project teaches girls how to make sanitary pads and other skills, says there is a need to encourage entrepreneurship skills in a girl child to help her find food for the whole family. Lameki Masina, VOA News, Blantyre.
Ongoing rainfall on Tuesday led to the closure of some key roads in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, with many people being forced to stay at home. For more on the situation, VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached journalist Taji Luandi.
The rains in Dar today were not as heavy as they were the day before. The thing with Dar right now is we have four districts. It could be raining very heavily in one, but it could be rather quiet in the other. But they've been devastating, to say the least. The road the day before yesterday, city center, different locales just outside the city were all inundated underwater. There was flowing water. It wasn't as bad as we've seen in Dubai. But it was very unusual for many parts to have so much water streaming down either paved roads or unpaved roads. So you could say that yesterday Dar was pretty much underwater. Main areas where it's tricky, it's always tricky, like an area called Yangwani, that was closed off, impassable except for maybe motorcycle, boda boda, we call them, riders who were also having a very difficult time traversing the bridge that links town with the suburb of Dar es Salaam. And in the outskirts, it's also really bad. I had friends that I requested for videos, and so different parts of Dar es Salaam affected badly by rainfall hours, probably some 4 hours, some 6 hours, and pretty much almost 12 hours constant rainfall. So that was a lot of water pouring down on Dar es Salaam in a short, you know, throughout the whole day yesterday.
We understand that the government authority had to close some roads in Dar es Salaam. How did that affect movement and business?
Well, Dar es Salaam is notorious for long queues and terrible traffic whenever rain falls, even if it's a little bit of rainfall for about an hour. So it's quite chaotic. The city is very condensed, and so moving around with your car, or with so many people driving into town with their cars, and also being a residential city as well, you can imagine if everybody's still using their cars, is very chaotic. And I think a lot of people are going to get home very, very late. The traffic queues in the evening begin to dissipate well after 9 or 10 p.m.
Taji Liyonde is a Tanzania-based journalist. He spoke from Dar es Salaam with VOA's Douglas Umpoga. Artificial intelligence surrounds U.S. political life, from fundraising to campaign advertising. Some lawmakers are looking to better police in the use of generative content in this year's presidential election, as they say it threatens voter confidence in what is real. VOA correspondent Cass Stearns has this story.
So far, artificial intelligence in this presidential campaign has been most pronounced in the New Hampshire primary, where thousands of voters received a call from a voice sounding like Joe Biden telling them not to vote.
Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again.
The fake voice was made by Louisiana magician Paul Carpenter for $150.
If anybody's looking for some kind of flag, not a false flag, but like a flag, a gameplay flag where something bad happened, and I'm the flag.
U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal says there's no time to wait for another flag.
Disinformation and deepfakes are about to descend on the American public. The form of their arrival will be political ads and other forms of disinformation that are made possible by artificial intelligence. There is a clear and present danger to our democracy.
At a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on AI in this election last week, Senator Josh Hawley said it's time to act.
The dangers of this technology without guardrails and without safety features are becoming painfully, painfully apparent. And I think the question now is that are we going to have to watch some catastrophe unfold?
It's already possible to detect calls like the one in New Hampshire, says artificial voice generation developer Zohaib Ahmed.
We believe that AI watermarking technology is a readily available solution that can already check the integrity of audio content.
With that technology in place, what's lacking is regulation, says deepfake detection entrepreneur Ben Coleman.
There's a really nice framework in both national and also state-level regulations in the space. When you upload something on, for example, YouTube, it's checking for a few things. It's checking for violence. It's checking for underage imagery. It's checking for, are you uploading the latest Drake song? That's because of regulations. So to scan for generative media would just be another check within that same flow.
The U.S. Federal Election Commission is considering rules that would prohibit using AI in ads to deliberately deceive voters. New Hampshire Secretary of State David Scanlon told the Senate committee that unchecked generative AI, like the fake Biden call, threatens voter confidence.
The most fundamental, important thing that I perceive in my role as Secretary of State is to make sure that an election is not messed up, that, you know, the voters believe and know that it was run fairly and accurately to the highest standards possible. And if we lose that, it will be very, very hard to get it back.
In New Hampshire, lawmakers are working to require that political advertising within 90 days of an election disclose if audio, still images, or video have, quote, been manipulated or generated by artificial intelligence technology and depicts speech or conduct that did not occur. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Wednesday, April 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botti, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.